influxes at which the high command could hardly claim surprise, meant that the Stalags were soon overflowing and the Dulags becoming permanent fixtures. The Stalags often lacked proper buildings and heating facilities, but conditions in the Dulags were far worse, for by their very nature they were ill-equipped to house large numbers of prisoners for any duration. One such camp housed 20,000 POWs, even though it had been built for a tenth of that number. Lack of proper sanitation and shelter exposed POWs to disease and eventually to the worsening weather. The sometimes complete absence of any shelter soon earned the Dulags the blackly humorous sobriquet of summer camps. While the mass death of Soviet POWs rarely escalated in the winter of 1941 to 1942, the process was already well underway by autumn. On 19 October, for instance, as Christian Streit explains, the OKW was informed that in the general government, the mass death among the POWs cannot be stopped, since they have reached the point of exhaustion. Over the following 10 days alone, 4,500 POWs in the camps there died every single day. These prisoners had been treated and fed not amid any kind of crisis that had taken the OKH and OKW by surprise, but in accordance with the principles that both high command bodies had themselves laid down in the spring of 1941. On 21 October, General Wagner decided to reduce POW rations further. Now, prisoners who were able to work were to receive just under 2,200 calories, but those unable to work were to receive fewer than 1,500. By 23 November, Wagner was explicitly stating that POWs who were not working should be left to starve to death. Some field commanders maintained that cutting POWs' rations was necessary in order to ease their own troops' supply problems, but Wagner was not just cutting them for this reason. He was also observing the Nazi regime's wish to maintain home front morale by avoiding civilian rationing. As starvation spread through the camps, some prisoners tried to survive by grabbing what they could from the moldy scraps that German POW camp personnel threw out from their kitchens. Others resorted to cannibalism. Prisoners kept arriving in droves at the now teeming camps well into November. Plummeting temperatures from October onwards added to the death rates. Then, with the coming of winter, the insanitary conditions unleashed a typhus epidemic. Although the OKH had ordered that medical facilities be provided for the camps in July 1941, these were rudimentary, manned by often untrained Soviet civilians or POWs, and intended purely to prevent the Reich itself from being overwhelmed with Russian wounded. The camps, lacking sufficient serum and delousing equipment, among other things, were thus pitifully unprepared to combat such an epidemic. Only in December 1941 did the OKH get around even to announcing that proper delousing stations would be built, and then in the Stalags alone. Middle-aged and elderly officers, men who had been socialized in a time well before the Nazis, ran many of the camp administrations. Insofar as they were practically able, they often did what they could for their POWs with the paltry resources at their disposal. Some sought to circumvent their lack of medical facilities by requiring the local population to tend to wounded POWs. Others gave their POWs extra provisions, though this particular measure merely moved the problem elsewhere, because it involved seizing more food from local civilians. Konrad Jarosch, a middle-aged NCO supervising Russian kitchen staff at Dulag 203, had been an admirer of the Nazis, if not an especially fervent one, but he was appalled by the prisoners' suffering. His horror was augmented by his strong Christian beliefs. A letter home of 8 January 1942 described scenes of dying on a horrifying scale. Over the next few days we may be able to increase the rations, but that isn't going to help any more. There was a limit to how much difference his own efforts could make, and in January 1942 he too succumbed to typhus. Ordinary soldiers also showed humanity, to the extent that on 27 December 1941, General Strauss, Model's predecessor as commander of the Ninth Army, intervened against them. "It has come to my attention," he declared, "that soldiers could avoid freezing more if they were less soft-headed and mulish. There are cases of some infantrymen in their normal kit being less prepared for the cold than the captive Red Army soldiers to whom they've been giving fur coats, fur hats, and felt boots. Such acts may have been qualified shows of humanity, for these items could well have been seized from Soviet civilians and POWs in the first place. Yet bugged conversations between German soldiers in British and American captivity later in the war did reveal that, though their anti-Semitic conditioning often caused them to view the mass killing of Soviet Jews with ambivalence, they were rather more disturbed at the uncomradely way in which the Wehrmacht had allowed Soviet POWs to perish wholesale. Although Hitler had sought to keep the POWs away from German soil altogether, some were being transferred to the Reich as a labor force from as early as July 1941. For reasons of security and ideological consistency, they were to be kept in purpose-built Russenlager, Russian camps. The organization of these camps, like that of the Stalags and Dulags further east, was lamentable. They were to be built with concrete, but took far too long to construct, and such medical facilities and delousing stations as they contained were hopelessly inadequate. Moreover, as a parallel system of camps, administering them required an entirely new organization, one for which, again, too few personnel were available. By the winter of 1941 to 1942, only 12 of the envisaged 20 Russenlager had been built, and the conditions within them were every bit as deadly as in camps further east. Eventually, a large number of this particular group of POWs was transferred to general POW camps inside Germany. Mass death ensued anyway. About half the prisoners perished within the first few months of captivity, and most were too weak to carry out the labor tasks they were to have been assigned. Over the course of 1941, the Wehrmacht eventually handed over 30,000 such POWs as slaves for the industries being run from the concentration camps. Among them was a group of POWs who were killed in the Zyklon B gas experiments in Auschwitz in October 1941. German military lawyers protested to Field Marshal Keitel about the POW situation, reminding him of Germany's obligations to the Soviet POWs even though the Soviet Union had not signed the Geneva Convention, but he ignored them. Field Marshal von Bock and General von Schenkendorf were among those senior commanders who pressed for measures that would alleviate prisoners' suffering. They stressed that prisoners with evidently nothing to lose were much more likely to try and escape to join partisan groups. Regardless of whether such commanders were making pragmatic arguments to conceal their moral consternation, their pleas were to no immediate avail. Other senior commanders, such as Küchler, intervened only after continued pressure from their administrative staffs. Küchler, like many senior commanders, only showed proper concern for the POW's situation when he began seeing their value as a source of labor. This need grew more urgent as the Germans went over from offensive to static warfare, and needed the POW's labor for a host of practical tasks such as building defensive positions or clearing roads and minefields. Some German units also began recruiting POWs, particularly Cossacks, as military auxiliaries. For instance, at the end of October, Army Group Center ordered that Cossack units, mounted units, and pioneer groups be formed from released Cossack, Ukrainian, or White Ruthenian prisoners, trained, organized, and put into action. Some prisoners were eventually sent home on early release schemes, though as well as being few in number, only Balts and Ukrainians benefited from these. The Nazi leadership, meanwhile, came to see the benefit in employing Soviet POWs as forced labor in the German war economy. Furthermore, as the German army came to contemplate occupying the Soviet Union as a long-term commitment, army commanders increasingly saw the value of keeping POWs alive for propaganda purposes. Indeed, because the mass death of Soviet POWs took place under the noses of the occupied population, it did much to embitter civilians against the Germans. Commanders were also mindful of the full consequences of the typhus epidemic, for, as Konrad Jarosz exemplified, it was not just Soviet POWs whom the disease was felling. In the face of all these entreaties and concerns, the OKH eventually introduced new measures that brought some improvement to POWs' conditions. They came far too late to prevent death on a colossal scale, however. Of the 5.7 million Soviet troops taken prisoner by the Germans during the Second World War, 3.3 million perished, of whom 2 million had already perished by the beginning of February 1942. Indeed, it was partly because so many POWs had died that the Germans now had the facilities to keep some of the remainder alive, but even then a further 1.3 million would perish by the end of the war. Germany did not suddenly lose the strategic initiative during the winter of 1941 to 1942. It was beginning to lose it as early as the previous summer. Rather, the winter foreshadowed the way in which the German army would develop as a result of its new reality. Hitler's self-appointment as head of the army constrained his general's freedom of maneuver even more. As far as the officer corps as a whole was concerned, the army would come to place increasing importance on resilience, obduracy, and ideological conviction as criteria for promotion. Hitler was far more impressed by individuals who displayed these characteristics than by individuals from the officer corps' traditional social circles. This was not a radical departure from the officer corps of 1941, but it did further embed the harsher qualities that the army was already displaying. Indeed, Hitler was soon crediting these very qualities with the fact that the army eventually came through the fire against the Red Army's winter counteroffensive. This was to ignore other crucial reasons why the German army endured on the Eastern Front that winter: its assured performance in defensive warfare, particularly from its infantry, and the Red Army's markedly less assured performance in the attack. However, there can be little serious doubt that an obdurate spirit fusing ideological and military harshness increasingly animated the German army from senior officers down to many frontline soldiers. As to the mass death of Soviet POWs, although the army leadership had not consciously decided to exterminate this group at the outset of the Barbarossa campaign, one could fairly say that it may as well have done so. It failed even to begin to consider the basic requirements of the enormous POW population that it could realistically expect to amass. Instead, it sacrificed such concerns in favor of what it perceived to be the Reich's domestic and military needs. Then, as the full scale of death and suffering among the POWs became clear, General Wagner consciously declared that they should be left to starve to death. Only belatedly, due to practical pressures, economic calculation, and, to a lesser extent, injunctions by some frontline commanders, did the army leadership take any steps to reduce death rates among the prisoners. Throughout this process, the army leadership, and indeed numerous senior commanders, displayed a mix of racial contempt and callous utilitarian indifference towards the suffering of the Soviet POWs. The army leadership's attitude here shared something with the mentality of ideological and military harshness that increasingly shaped the army's attitude towards the fighting at the front. Whether at the front or in the POW camps, such a mentality did not mark individual units and soldiers in a uniform way. Their age profile, their region of origin, and the particular conditions they faced were among the many forces that could also influence their behavior. But the two crises, one at the front and one in the rear, were also connected in a further way. For the mass death of Soviet POWs highlights a further reason why the German army would continue to fight so tenaciously during the war's final 3.5 years. Its fear of what defeat at the hands of a vengeful Red Army would mean. And indeed, against an Allied coalition that now included the United States, the prospect of total defeat no longer seemed fanciful. Chapter 12. The Desert War, 1941-1942. The campaign the German army waged in the western desert of Libya and Egypt under General, later Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, is the most mythologized of the Second World War. James Mason's portrayal of Rommel in the 1951 feature film The Desert Fox is only the most famous example of a Rommel industry of films and biographies that the life of Germany's most famous general of the Second World War has generated. Rommel is the general whom people in the West have associated most closely with the German officer corps' essentially decent, apolitical, popular image. He is also widely applauded as one of history's most brilliant commanders. In more recent decades, however, Rommel's reputation has come under fire on both fronts. There is much to indicate that he was an admirer and follower of Hitler and the Nazis for much of the war. "He isn't just close to National Socialism," wrote Goebbels in October 1942. "He is a National Socialist. If he wasn't, he wouldn't have got further than Colonel." Nor, in contrast to his depiction in The Desert Fox, did Rommel play an active role in the army officer's plot to assassinate Hitler in 1944. As for his performance as a commander, ascribing powers of military genius to him suited both the Germans and the British. The Germans used him as a much-needed propaganda figure at a time when their grip on the war was increasingly unsure, and the British used him as an excuse for their own military ineptitude. Yet Rommel's reputation as a military tactician par excellence overlooks his less than accomplished grasp of logistics, and above all of strategy. It also overlooks the serious weaknesses that sometimes marked the performance of his troops, who, after all, were eventually completely defeated, and by an opponent who had not only amassed superior resources, but also learned to marshal them effectively. Yet while the unblemished Rommel legend undoubtedly fails to withstand close scrutiny, the unbridled Rommel backlash of more recent decades has also been overdone. It would be fair to argue, even if it risks cliché, that the truth lies somewhere in between. The German army became involved in North Africa in order to bail out Germany's hapless ally, fascist Italy. Mussolini had sought to expand his empire in the Mediterranean and Middle East by invading British-controlled Egypt from the neighboring Italian colony of Libya. The Italian offensive failed miserably, and the British Western Desert Force then launched a counter-thrust into the Libyan province of Cyrenaica. Hitler initially dispatched Rommel with a token force, the nucleus of the German Afrika Korps, Deutsches Afrika Korps, or DAK, to Tripoli in February 1941. The aim was to prevent the complete collapse of the Italian army in North Africa, and with it, possibly, Italy's complete withdrawal from the war. But in 1942, Rommel's victories assumed their own momentum, and the Nazi leadership backed him primarily for the aforementioned reasons of prestige as he sought to drive the British out of Egypt. The Allies, particularly the British, had much to lose in the North African campaign. Relinquishing control of the Suez Canal and the oil of the Middle East would have maimed Britain's war effort. While this in itself would not necessarily have been fatal, an Axis defeat of the British in North Africa might have discouraged the United States from committing to the war in Europe as early and as fulsomely as it eventually did. The Western Allies would also have lost an important opportunity to develop their military proficiency in a subsidiary campaign. Many of the lessons learned in North Africa, and in the land battles of the Mediterranean theatre more generally, proved immensely valuable when the Allies embarked upon liberating mainland Western Europe from German occupation. For the Germans, too, the North African campaign was important. If the Germans had not at least propped up the Italians in North Africa, Italy might have left the war and ruptured the Axis alliance. In immediate military terms, this in itself need not have been serious. But diplomatically and politically it would have been disastrous, for Germany needed to be seen helping its allies if it were to attract more countries to the Axis. A defeated Italy would leave a vacuum in southern Europe that the Allies could exploit. It might have also prompted Germany's Axis satellites, Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia, to jump ship or even change sides. In short, both sides had a considerable amount riding on the North African campaign. The difference was that the British appreciated this fully, Hitler and the German High Command rather less so. The campaign possessed unusual characteristics. For one thing, far fewer troops fought in North Africa than in the Soviet Union. The environment also shaped the fighting more fundamentally than in other theatres, even more so than in the Soviet Union. So inhospitable and impassable was the interior that the fighting took place on a coastal strip. Although it was relatively narrow, this contained large stretches of open terrain ideal for armoured warfare. The environment also made immense physical demands upon the soldiers. They endured extremes of desert temperature round the clock. By day, the desert sun was merciless, while at night temperatures could plunge to zero. The desert could also deceive the eye. Among other things, as a report by the 15th Panzer Division's 33rd Reconnaissance Section highlighted, the lack of easily identifiable terrain features made it even more imperative for patrols to judge distances correctly. The landscape itself could also change due to rain and sandstorms. Only in-depth navigation could overcome this particular challenge. Hans von Luck, who assumed command of the 3rd Panzer Reconnaissance Battalion in April 1942, later recalled further miseries and tricks that the desert inflicted upon the troops. "I got used to the Fata Morgana, the mirage, which looked so hopefully like a lake, but which on approach dissolved into nothing. I had also to get accustomed to the ferocious sandstorm, which the Italians called the Ghibli. It usually lasted for a day, but sometimes for three. One could see it coming. The sky grew dark, the fine sand penetrated every pore and made any movement, let alone any military operation, impossible. Furthermore, particularly unusual logistical hurdles bedeviled both sides, though they came to affect the Axis most of all. Axis supplies had to cross the Mediterranean, while British supplies could come around the Cape of Good Hope or up the Suez Canal. The Mediterranean, therefore, was itself a battleground for the entire duration of the North African campaign, as Axis shipping seeking to reach North Africa ran the gauntlet of British and later U.S. naval and air power. The key to the Mediterranean was the British naval base on Malta. The island was a vital fortified location and refueling stop for Allied warships and combat aircraft out to disrupt Axis convoys, and successfully withstood repeated Axis aerial assault. Then, once they actually reached North Africa, both Axis and Allied supplies had to reckon with the region's minimal transport infrastructure. Moreover, any chance either side had of mounting and sustaining an offensive depended on control of the oases along the desert supply routes. As a result of all the logistical impediments the Axis faced, it took 10 times as much supply transport to keep the 3 divisions of Rommel's Afrika Korps in the field compared with 3 divisions in the Soviet Union. This was a major reason why the German High Command never invested in the North African campaign as much as it might have done. Letters and reports by officers and men of the 15th Panzer Division, one of the key Afrika Korps units, convey much of the campaign's flavor. Feldwebel Arnold D. wrote at the end of April 1941, "With a few exceptions, the war here is a war of movement. We have to overcome distances and areas that it's impossible to convey an impression of, even through photos." The following May, Lance Corporal Siegfried K. described heat of 40 degrees and being thirsty isn't an option. "It's terrible when one is thirsty and has nothing more to drink. I mustn't think of Böblingen, how often I got drunk there out of boredom, or, more often the case with me, to get over thirst. Today I'd be pleased if I had just a small amount of what I had before to drink. Worse than the heat are the sandstorms. They're more terrible than words can describe. We copped one the day before yesterday. The sand gets into every joint, even when you're wearing glasses." Initially, German vehicle filters could not cope with the sand. During the Afrika Korps' first offensive into Cyrenaica in the spring of 1941, many of its vehicles got lost or ran out of fuel. Nevertheless, so hardy did the German troops prove in this merciless environment that the British thought they had been specially trained in purpose-built greenhouses back in Germany. The first forward units of the 5th Light Motorized Division disembarked at Tripoli on 25 February 1941. By the beginning of April, the entire division had been brought across, with the 15th Panzer Division to follow. Rommel employed dummy tanks to inflate the size of this force when it first arrived. Colonel von Mellentin, who served variously as Rommel's intelligence officer and operations officer between the summer of 1941 and the summer of 1942, alluded to the sometimes hair-raising experience of serving on his staff. As a rule, Rommel expected his chief of staff to accompany him on visits to the front, which frequently meant into the very forefront of the battle. This was contrary to the accepted general staff principle, that the chief of staff is the deputy of the commander-in-chief during the latter's absence. But Rommel liked to have his principal adviser always at his elbow, and if he became a casualty, well, he could always be replaced. Overall, however, Rommel was not an especially inventive military thinker. Rather, the desert enabled him to become a purveyor par excellence of armoured warfare. "The principles laid down to tank warfare have been entirely justified and should be applied unchanged," Rommel later wrote. "The desert is ideal tank country with unlimited space for manoeuvre." Officially, Rommel's superior was the Italian commander-in-chief in Libya, Marshal Rodolfo Graziani. In reality, Rommel answered to the commander-in-chief of the German army. Practically, and from December 1941, officially, this meant Hitler. The Italians ordered Rommel to restrict his operations to reconnaissance, but 2 weeks after German forces had started arriving, he believed he had amassed sufficient strength for a full-scale offensive. When he reached the authorized limit of his advance on 24 March, he pushed on. Rommel defeated the British 2nd Armoured Division at Mersa Brega on 31 March and drove the British out of most of Cyrenaica. He then had his first crack at capturing Tobruk, a particularly well-situated port for supplying offensives in this theatre. Throughout this initial phase of his campaigning in North Africa, Rommel led from the front as energetically as he had in the West in 1940, using his Fieseler Storch spotter plane to scout the terrain and opposition, and then descend upon his commanders to spur them on personally. Indeed, overall, Rommel's desert aerial reconnaissance outperformed that of the British during 1941 and much of 1942. An experience report compiled by the 15th Panzer Division, entitled Es Rommelt, Rommeling, conveyed the general's way of doing things. "Our group isn't large, a few anti-tank guns, a handful of tanks, and 2 infantry platoons. But Rommel is moving forward, so everything clicks. We haven't gone far before we meet the British, so it's artillery forward to take direct fire. We tear into action, get in position, and the first shot flies out. Too short. Add 200 meters, 650 feet. Rommel is in the middle of it all. Now we fire shot after shot at the vehicles ahead of us, and the Tommies seek escape in wild flight. The general stands next to our guns. He's clearly getting a lot of fun out of our merciless firing. Knock them out, boys, fire! Thus does he spur on the gunners further." Due to their code-breaking efforts, the British knew the Germans possessed only a small force, and so the British Commander-in-Chief Middle East, General Sir Archibald Wavell, had not expected them to attack before May. Hence, on this occasion, British code-breaking proved a curse disguised as a blessing, for when Rommel did attack in March and into April, Wavell was caught on the back foot, and this at a time when he had been forced to commit many of his troops to the fighting in Greece. Wavell nonetheless aimed to wrestle back eastern Cyrenaica from the Germans and Italians, and, it was hoped, reopen a link with the now besieged Tobruk. In mid-May, he launched a counterattack, Operation Brevity, in the Solom region on the Libyan-Egyptian border. But Brevity made little headway. The Africa Corps did not counterattack, but only because it preferred to let its 88mm anti-tank guns finish off the British. A follow-up British offensive in mid-June, Operation Battle Axe, likewise failed, and led to Churchill replacing Wavell with General Sir Claude Auchinleck. Booting the Western Desert Force out of Cyrenaica and then blunting all British efforts to counterattack had been a satisfying achievement for the Axis troops. Although a number of Italian units, contrary to the often deplorable popular image of the Italian army's fighting power, regularly provided valuable support for the Germans, it was clearly the presence of Rommel and the Afrika Korps that had transformed Axis fortunes. In turn, the backbone of the Afrika Korps was its panzers, specifically its Mark IIIs and IVs. The panzers' high-quality training and tactics proved markedly superior to those of the British in the Western Desert. The Afrika Korps successfully replicated the Panzer Division's structure as a mini-army. Its panzers advanced in combined arms battle groups moving in box formation. Their standard maneuver involved, when such a box encountered the enemy, taking up an all-round defensive position and deploying its panzers along a wide front. The panzers would then withdraw slowly to positions either side of the box. When British tanks attacked, the panzers withdrew further on both sides. Thus, as the British rushed to engage one group of panzers, they faced fire from anti-tank guns on their flank. The panzers on which the British tanks had been advancing then turned and engaged the British themselves. Meanwhile, the panzers on the unengaged side would swing round to encircle and attack the British from the rear. Intricate as these manoeuvres were, the Germans could pull them off because they possessed command cars fitted with radios. With these, they could coordinate with and monitor the radios of the individual panzers. Moreover, by perfecting such manoeuvres through incessant battle drill, the Afrika Korps was able to operate in battle on the basis of extremely concise verbal commands. The British made for an unedifying contrast, particularly when it came to combined arms practice. Their infantry-artillery coordination was especially poor. Among other things, the British often used field artillery in an anti-tank role and thus deprived their infantry of its support. Their inferior communications were of no help either. Unlike the Germans, the British lacked radios in sufficient numbers. It was also harder for them to give concise verbal commands in the way the Germans did, because the particularly multinational nature of their force, which eventually included Free French and Greek units as well as British and British Commonwealth and Empire formations, meant they had multiple operating procedures. Armoured engagements could still be fierce and close-run. Lance Corporal Wolfgang H. of the 15th Panzer Division described one such clash during Operation Battle Axe. Tommy wanted to break through to relieve his besieged troops in Tobruk. You can't imagine how dramatic this battle was. My company has lost 80% of its strength. We were pleased when the battle came to an end. 200 English tanks covered the landscape. British armoured tactics crudely resembled old-fashioned cavalry charges. While it is tempting to attribute this to a tally-ho chap's mentality, it was more an attempt to compensate for the fact that British tanks, hobbled by the ongoing failings of British tank design, were technically inferior. The Mark IV Panzer, fitted with the long 75mm cannon, was more than a match for any British tank. The Matilda was particularly vulnerable to German anti-tank fire. Its successor, the Valentine, had thicker armour, but was no faster or better armed. The Crusader tank was underpowered, which prevented the British from thickening its armour in the same way the Germans could with their panzers. The Germans' versatile 88mm anti-tank guns exacted a particularly heavy toll on British armour. Thus, British tank units, knowing they could not avoid fighting but also fearing German firepower, often resorted to waiting in the hope that their own artillery would destroy the German anti-tank guns. This, of course, denied British tank units the element of surprise. The only alternative was the aforementioned cavalry charge, in which British armoured formations tried to overrun the German anti-tank guns, in David French's words, in the usually vain hope that they could overrun them before they themselves had been blown to pieces. During Operation Battle Axe, Matildas suffered especially against 88s dug in so well that only their barrels showed above ground. Moreover, the RAF was focusing much of its energy on the early stages of the strategic bombing of Germany during 1941 and 1942, so the Western Desert Force lacked proper tactical air support. The British failure in Operation Battle Axe did lead to the creation of the Desert Air Force, but air-ground communication still took time to improve. On the other hand, Rommel's first offensive also exposed some of his own failings. He had no qualms about mercilessly driving his troops. Whenever his vehicles got lost or ran out of fuel, he tolerated no hold-ups, tearing around the forward areas, driving his men onwards. This haranguing approach had its advantages. The pace of the advance was indicated in a letter by Private Klaus N. of 11 June 1941. "The fighting is hard. Tommy is getting a kicking," he wrote. "Otherwise things are moving forward really fast in this hot land." But it also risked driving men and machines to exhaustion. In October, the 15th Panzer Division's 11th Infantry Regiment stressed that an urgent priority for the first weeks of refitting is the re-establishment of previous strength. Weapons, vehicles, and equipment need a fundamental durable overhaul. Further, while Rommel's penchant for dashing around his frontline units often made for energetic and effective leadership, it could also cause him to lose sight of the bigger operational picture and end up in the wrong place to coordinate the fight most effectively. For instance, he lost the opportunity to achieve an even more decisive victory against Operation Brevity on the Somme front because he was too busy driving his men before Tobruk. The Afrika Korps and the Luftwaffe also coordinated poorly during the Somme fighting. Rommel's first attempt to take Tobruk in the spring of 1941 exemplified both his impetuosity and the demands he placed on his troops. British and Commonwealth forces had captured Tobruk from the Italians in January. The Australian troops now stationed there had had time to fortify the port more formidably, and it was also being reinforced by sea. On 11 April, the 5th Light Division assaulted Tobruk, but the Germans were too lightly armed and faltered before the defenders' anti-tank ditch. On the 12th, they were stopped by sandstorms, and on the 13th by artillery and anti-tank fire. So, too, were attacks by Italian troops. A reinforced attack the following month similarly wilted in the teeth of the defenders' strong defensive firepower. Rommel's troops also still lacked experience, as he himself later recalled. The high casualties suffered by my assault forces were primarily caused by the lack of training. It frequently happened that dash was used where caution was really needed, with, of course, casualties as the result. For the next occasion, when boldness really was required, the men would be overcautious. Rommel also had to relinquish his air support temporarily when it was transferred to operations over Crete and the Nile Delta. Rommel's failure at Tobruk also showcased another of his unappealing traits, his habit of blaming the Italians, even though it was Rommel himself who had sent them in against the odds. Rommel and his men regularly castigated their Italian allies. One of the kinder comments came from 2nd Lieutenant André F. of the 15th Panzer Division, who wrote in May, "One must treat the Italians as children. They're no good as soldiers, but they're the best comrades. You can get anything from them." Mussolini is the most un-Italian Italian in his thinking, for, among the Italian troops, you never see any sign of the idea of fascism. The dolce far niente, life of doing nothing, reigns supreme. It would be fairer to say that a good number of Italian units, such as the elite Bersaglieri, gave valuable support to the Germans in the desert, but then made perfect scapegoats when things went wrong. Colonel von Mellentin, though conscious of serial defects in the Italian army, defended the ordinary Italian soldier in his memoirs. "I have no sympathy with those who talk contemptuously about the Italian soldier," he stated, without pausing to consider the disadvantages under which he labored. Rommel, too, reserved special contempt for Italian commanders rather than for their men. His derision is clear in a letter to his wife of 31 August. "The Italian high command is dissatisfied having so little say in things here. They mess us about over all manner of petty details, but we don't take any of it lying down. Maybe they're working for a real bust-up in order to get me, or perhaps the whole German force, out of the way." But nor did Rommel spare his German subordinates a verbal lashing. The unfortunate recipient after the failure at Tobruk was Major General Johannes Streich, commander of the 5th Light Division. According to Rommel's aide-de-camp, Lieutenant Schmidt, the commander of the Afrika Corps gave vent to his anger openly and used blunt words, such as presumably only one general may use to another. General Halder had been skeptical about the whole North African enterprise from the start. Forgetting that his own planning for Barbarossa did not have the firmest grounding in reality either, he was appalled at Rommel's rashness and chastised him for flouting his original orders. "Rommel is reporting that he does not have enough power to exploit this unique opportunity," he recorded in his diary. "Well, we've known that at this end for a long time." Halder was particularly incensed that Rommel was pushing ahead regardless of his severe supply restrictions. Only an airborne invasion of Malta, a seaborne landing was out of the question due to the island's high cliffs, would have eased this situation. Yet an airborne invasion was also out of the question, once Hitler had decided to commit paratroop forces against Crete instead. "Rommel has exceeded his orders," wrote Halder, "and created a situation which the supply possibilities at the moment are no longer equal to." Then, on 23 April, after Rommel had gone quiet for a few days, Halder fumed that the general just bounces around his widely dispersed units, forays out on adventures, and fritters away his troops. Halder then sent General Paulus, the deputy chief of operations at the OKH, to North Africa to remind Rommel of what he was supposed to be doing there, performing a defensive role with minimal help. "Paulus knows him from previous military service," Halder maintained, "and is perhaps the only one who can rein in this soldier who has gone mad." Paulus visited Rommel at the end of April. His initially favorable impression evaporated when he saw the Axis troops' heavily exposed positions at Solom, the demands the harsh conditions were making upon them, and the dogged resistance of the Australians at Tobruk. Paulus reported back to Hulda at the beginning of May, blaming Rommel for the situation and confirming the scale of the logistical mountain facing him. Rommel now received direct orders forbidding him to attack Tobruk again without higher authority. Generally, however, Hitler's protection of Rommel placed a check on what Hulda could do, and responsibility for the North African theatre was eventually transferred from the OKH to the OKW. On 19 July, Hitler promoted Rommel to the rank of General of Panzer Troops and appointed him commander of the new Panzer Group Africa, which comprised both the Afrika Korps and the Italian formations. General Kruvel, arriving from the Eastern Front, took over direct command of the Afrika Korps, while Major General Westphal became Rommel's new chief of operations. Although Rommel often hurled abuse at them, both Kruvel and the new command staff worked hard to improve the Panzer Group's efficiency. Yet on the British side, while the Western Desert Force was renamed the Eighth Army and placed under General Alan Cunningham, it remained no less organizationally and tactically defective than before. In November, the British were able to use their naval superiority to sever Axis supplies to North Africa temporarily, and on the 18th, General Auchinleck counterattacked with Operation Crusader. In one respect, Crusader showed the way for the British. To some extent, it tried to commit the now numerically inferior Axis forces to the kind of attritional set-piece battle in which the British would later become much more successful. The strength of the British force was eventually blunted after the Afrika Korps virtually destroyed the British 7th Armoured Brigade at Sidi Rezegh. The British also failed to reach the still-isolated port of Tobruk. Nevertheless, Rommel coordinated the German counterattack poorly, sending unclear radio messages to the various units and popping up here and there to order armoured thrusts without thought for their wider operational value. Crusader also exposed Rommel's sizable, ungracious streak. Kruvel should have been credited with some of the key decisions taken during the fighting, but Rommel seized the accolades for himself. By December, the sides had bludgeoned one another into exhaustion. On balance, however, Panzer Group Africa had had the better of the action because it had forced a stalemate despite being outnumbered. Auchinleck replaced the nervously exhausted Cunningham with General Neil Ritchie. Millantin estimated that while the British had been badly mauled during Operation Crusader, their strength would increase again after January. Meanwhile, however, a Royal Navy flotilla was lost to sea mines, and the Luftwaffe's two air corps arrived on Sicily to put pressure on Malta and loosen the British stranglehold on the Axis supply routes. All this created a narrow window of opportunity in which to attack the British again. The newly renamed Panzer Army Africa attacked on 21 January 1942. 4 days later, as Rommel recounted, the Germans savaged the British 1st Armoured Division, breaking into the enemy at tearing speed and throwing him into complete confusion. By the end of January, the Axis had captured Benghazi and, apart from Tobruk, had driven the British out of Cyrenaica altogether. To his credit, Rommel praised both his Italian and German troops this time, but Axis losses had been heavier than those of the British, and Benghazi's capture proved a disappointment. The fuel bonanza Rommel had hoped for did not come up to expectations, and capturing the port did not replace the long overland route from Tripoli, it merely shortened it. May and June 1942 brought Rommel's greatest victory. He broke through the latest British defensive position on the Gazala line, the northern end of which was about 24 kilometres, 15 miles west of Tobruk. On paper, the two forces were evenly matched, and the British hoped Gazala would not be outflanked from the south. However, the British system of defensive boxes, each manned by a brigade group and containing food and supplies for a week, was deeply flawed, for if British mobile troops could not stop the Axis thrusts, then the boxes could be easily cut off. Furthermore, though the British expected an attack, they did not know where it would fall, for their code-breaking operation at Bletchley Park had yet to become effective enough for signals to reach Cairo within 12 hours of the Germans transmitting them. Although the British still had more tanks than Panzer Army Africa, Rommel possessed other advantages. He expected his 88s would again help even the score, which they duly did, and he could also count on air superiority. The British themselves helped him yet again with their crude armoured tactics. Nevertheless, both sides suffered heavily during the battle's opening phase. Among other things, the 90th Light Motorized Division, which had arrived in North Africa in November 1941, and newly arrived Italian forces overcame particularly dogged resistance from foreign legionnaires of the Free French forces. One reason why the legionnaires put up such a ferocious struggle was that, because they belonged to a force whose mother country had surrendered to the Axis, they feared they would be killed if taken prisoner. The 1940 armistice had forbidden French citizens from fighting the Germans, and in November 1940 the OKW decreed that captured Free French soldiers were to be shot. It is not clear whether or not Rommel received this order, or what role he may or may not have played in deciding the fate of the legionnaires at Bir Hakeim. However, when Bir Hakeim did finally fall on 11th June, its defenders were not executed but sent into captivity. Now the Gazala line fell apart. Ritchie counterattacked, but to no avail. Lieutenant Rayada, a pioneer with the 15th Panzer Division, described the moment when a British armoured counterthrust in his sector was beaten off and British resistance collapsed. The artilleryman works precisely like a machine. Shot after shot leaves the barrel. Tommy's tanks have had enough. In panicked haste, they pull back. Our armoured personnel carriers move forward. The pioneers spring out, machine guns are brought up, and the first group rolls through the gap with hand grenades ready to throw. Precision fire on the individual foxholes and hand grenades thrown in soften up Tommy further. The first few come out of the forward foxholes and raise their hands. The fear has got into their bones and their faces are ashen. As the British retreated into Egypt, the Axis forces turned on the now perilously exposed Tobruk. Having extricated the majority of his forces, Ritchie retained some units in Tobruk, if for nothing else because relinquishing the port without a fight would have been unthinkable politically. In contrast with the attacks on Tobruk a year earlier, coordination between the Axis ground forces and the Luftwaffe was excellent. Stukas destroyed the port's barbed wire defences and supported the panzers in tank-to-tank fighting after Axis troops broke through the perimeter. Senior Corporal M. Reiter of Panzer Pioneer Battalion 33 described the assault. "We couldn't see anything of the enemy bunkers or tank ditches, but then our first wave of Stukas roared in. At the same moment our artillery got stuck in. The magical spectacle that the bombs and grenades created was indescribable. The smoke clouds rose vertically up to heaven, one appeared after another, and again the desert trembled with the impact." This time Tobruk fell. Hitler marked the occasion by promoting Rommel to field marshal. But now came the vexing question of what to do next. The Italians, still Rommel's nominal superiors, would have happily seen the Axis consolidate its position. Their own preferred next step, a view they shared with Field Marshal Kesselring, German Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean since November 1941, was to secure the Axis supply route by taking Malta with airborne troops. But as far as the Nazi leadership was now concerned, consolidating the Axis position in North Africa was not enough. With the United States now in the war, further German progress on the Eastern Front uncertain, and the RAF's first 1,000-bomber raid over Germany having recently taken place, Hitler and Goebbels believed success needed reinforcing wherever it could be found. Tobruk's fall, Rommel's promotion to field marshal, and the subsequent propaganda blitz had unleashed a wave of Rommel mania in Germany. Rommel, ever one to cultivate both the media and his Nazi leadership contacts, readily played along. Hitler reasoned that if the momentum of this necessary propaganda blitz were to be maintained, Rommel would need to go on the offensive again as quickly as possible. The obvious targets were the Nile Delta and the Suez Canal. Although a full-scale invasion of Egypt seemed a daunting prospect for Rommel's overstretched forces, the idea was not entirely foolhardy. Rommel was aware there was a new window of opportunity to hit the British while they were weak, and thanks to Italian military intelligence's efforts in deciphering messages from the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, he knew just how weak they were. Furthermore, the Germans had now captured as many as 6,000 usable British trucks. Rommel's order of the day of 21 June bristled with confidence. "Soldiers of the Panzer Armee Africa, now for the complete destruction of the enemy. "We will not rest until we have shattered the last remnants of the Eighth Army. During the days to come, I shall call on you for one more great effort to bring us to this final goal." Nor was this just a public show of bravado. "There'll be a few more battles to fight before we reach our goal," he wrote home at the end of the month, "but I think the worst is well behind us." Yet the obstacles were immense. Capturing Malta, thereby securing Axis supply across the Mediterranean, would have been a sensible prelude to any invasion of Egypt, but postponing the invasion of Egypt to take Malta was not an option. Rommel knew he could ill afford to give the British time to prepare. Their defense of Egypt benefited from shortened supply lines, and their forces were already growing again. In particular, 300 U.S. Sherman tanks were now Egypt-bound. In any case, Hitler was reluctant to drop parachute troops on Malta following the losses they had sustained on Crete, as well he might have been. For all these reasons, Malta remained an insoluble problem for the Axis. Plans to capture the island were shelved, and German paratroop forces that might have been used against the island were assigned to Rommel instead. Meanwhile, Kesselring would try at least to keep disrupting the British operation on Malta with continued aerial bombardment. But this in turn compelled him to reduce Rommel's air cover. In the event, though it achieved a very hard-won local victory at Mersa-Matru at the end of June, Panzer Army Africa would get no further than the British position at El Alamein. By now, Auchinleck had sent Ritchie the way of Cunningham, and had assumed command of the Eighth Army himself. Following the losses of May and June, Auchinleck was only able to commit two greatly weakened infantry divisions, one armored division, a further infantry division on the way, two infantry brigades, and a series of combat groups. To compensate for his shortage in artillery and armor, he elected on a defensive line hinged on the El Alamein position. Such a line could not be outflanked from the south, because there it bordered onto the Katara Depression, an immense sand sea impassable to tanks, and only about 50 kilometers, 30 miles, separated the northern end of the depression from the Mediterranean. In short, this was too small an area for Rommel to execute sweeping maneuvers around the British flank. It left Rommel no alternative but to attack the British head-on. Rommel attacked on 1 July, hoping to tempt the British into counter-attacking in the south. He would then advance through the night and penetrate the British line in the north. But Rommel now lacked reliable intelligence. His radio monitoring company roamed the desert as a mobile unit and provided Rommel with valuable information about British troop dispositions, but working out in the field rather than at headquarters deprived it of the bigger picture. The only high-level intelligence source available to Rommel had been closed off on 29 June, when the Americans had discovered and plugged the leak from their Cairo embassy. Furthermore, given Rommel's suddenly paltry air cover, the RAF now ruled the skies over Egypt and prevented the Axis from carrying out effective aerial reconnaissance. Moreover, British intelligence efforts were becoming much more proficient, with ultra-decrypts enabling Auchinleck to anticipate Rommel's every move. Ultra was a major weapon in an Allied intelligence effort that, inept though it was at the war's start, was becoming formidable by 1942. Ultra's success was a story of German failure as well as Allied achievement. The genesis of Ultra lay in the efforts of Polish cryptanalysts during the 1930s to reconstruct the Enigma mechanism, after a corruptible member of the Reichswehr's cipher team sold operating instructions and operating keys to the French. It was the capture or theft of further Enigma cipher key settings that led to the now world-famous wartime operation at Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire, England. Thousands of Enigma machines were used, with numerous variations, by all branches of German military and civilian authority. These variations required different branches to repeat the same message several times, and this gave Allied codebreakers the material they needed to reduce deciphering times. The Allies concealed their use of ultra-intelligence using various types of cover, such as Boniface, a fictitious secret agent working in German command offices, as well as POW interrogations that had actually taken place. On the few occasions when the Germans did consider the possibility that the Allies had breached Enigma, they blamed traitors rather than any fundamental flaw in the machinery. Generally, however, they did not believe the Allies had broken their cipher system, and their disbelief says much about German military attitudes under the Third Reich. The Enigma machine had originally been introduced by the Reichswehr during the 1920s. In keeping with the latter's stress on technical excellence, it was cutting-edge equipment for its time. The Germans also employed numerous safeguards for its use. For instance, they frequently changed service settings in case an Enigma machine fell into enemy hands, and each operator only had responsibility for portions of the daily setting in case one of them was captured. Yet the Germans gradually undercut the effectiveness of such safeguards. For one thing, they transmitted Enigma messages too repetitively, thus making it easier for Allied codebreakers to identify patterns. They also adhered to a central command structure in the transmission of messages. This negated the need for multiple ciphers and thus robbed Enigma of a further crucial security safeguard. Moreover, despite adherence to a central structure, the intelligence branches of the Army, Luftwaffe, Kriegsmarine, and SS all consider themselves separate organizations within that structure. They therefore failed to imagine that the Allies might glean information about one armed service from messages produced by another. Upgrades did not take place frequently enough or uniformly enough to keep ahead of Allied codebreakers, and sometimes through sheer laziness the Germans repeated settings from previous months. This particular gaffe reflected the Germans' general complacency over intelligence matters. The damage the Ultra Decrypts would wreak upon Rommel's chances was made clear at the very start of the First Battle of El Alamein on 1 July. When Rommel's attack went in, the 21st Panzer Division, the renamed and refitted 5th Light Division, received a hammering from the Desert Air Force. By now, the DAF was employing highly effective fighter bombers. The 90th Light Division received similar treatment from the British artillery. Rommel's own air cover, insofar as he had any, was nullified by a sandstorm and a lack of forward airfields. This 1 July assault had been Rommel's least poor chance of breaking through. When it failed, Indian and New Zealand troops backed by Allied fighter bombers held up the Axis forces the following day. Captain Dr. Teaser of the 33rd Panzerjäger section provided a flavor of the battle and of the pressure Panzer Army Africa was now under in an after-action report on an 8th Army counterattack on the southern flank. "We fought off a mixed infantry and tank attack, but we have lost 12 more men. The division radios that we must hold out at all costs. It is that serious. The radio operator who takes the message falls at his apparatus to a grenade splinter." That night, each of the section's machine guns was forced to cover a 400-meter, 1,300-foot front, each in the hands of an exhausted pioneer. The following night, at 11 p.m., a big explosion in the middle of my company's sector announces clearly that an enemy action is in progress. This time the enemy breaks through with strong infantry forces headed by troops specially trained for sabotage and detonation. One gun emplacement after another is blown sky high. Our defensive fire is amplified by the enormous detonations from the explosive devices the Australians are using. The wounded call for help all around. Australian and German soldiers hurl themselves at one another, and everyone fires against everyone in the darkness. On 3 July, with the Africa Corps down to 26 tanks, Rommel disengaged from the battle. Although Auchinleck had halted Panzer Army Africa, Churchill feared that too many of his generals were now suffering from Rommel psychosis following their serial defeats. He therefore sought out a fresh team that would not only stop Rommel but also decisively defeat him. Churchill eventually settled on a partnership of General Harold Alexander as Commander-in-Chief Middle East and Lieutenant General Bernard Montgomery as 8th Army Commander. But Auchinleck's effective stand at El Alamein had bought the new team the time it needed to rebuild the 8th Army. Rommel, for his part, had finally fallen short against a commander who had enjoyed air and intelligence superiority and had not counterattacked recklessly. After 1st Alamein, the Axis Air Force's ongoing failure to subdue Malta increasingly tipped the supply balance away from Panzer Army Africa. Rommel, belying his image as a rash hothead laughing in the face of logistics, later reflected on the situation thus: When it is remembered that in modern warfare supplies decide the battle, it is easy to see how the clouds of disaster were gathering for my army. My troops had at all times given of their best, but it had repeatedly been the superiority of certain German weapons over the British equivalents that had been our salvation. Now there were already signs in the new British tanks and anti-tank guns of a coming qualitative superiority of British material. If this were achieved, it would clearly mean the end for us. In August, the Axis lost 65,000 tons of shipping, compared with 20,000 in July. Rommel himself became passive and depressed. Kesselring protested that he was unable to give Rommel adequate air cover, pointing out that the Luftwaffe needed to keep pounding Malta now that plans to invade the island